Welcome to Pencils Down, a Finalis podcast. This is a show for listeners wanting to learn more about the ins and outs of the private securities brokerage landscape. Each episode will feature insightful conversations with the world's leading investment bankers, placement agents, capital providers, startup CEOs, and more. And with that, let's get into the show. All right, Nick McShane, thank you so much for joining us here on the Pencils Down podcast.
Very glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
I usually like to start by asking our guests to share a little bit about their backgrounds and the paths that led them to investment banking. Would love to learn a little bit of perspective just on your own story arc that led you to ultimately founding Progress Partners.
Sure. It's maybe a non-traditional way. I mean, I think a lot of boutique investment banks are formed by individuals or teams of people who come from a traditional investment banking bulge bracket market and go kind of boutique around a specialist, specializing around a sector or a certain type of banking. I actually started Progress Partners coming out of the operating side, working for tech companies back in the late 90s. So I was beneficiary of being part of Web 1.0 days, the 1997 to 2000 timeframe where the internet was blowing up, everything was possible. Out of nowhere, this whole industry of sort of digitizing different types of communication sort of started to hit the mainstream. And honestly, just I've sort of ridden that wave of digitization of advertising, marketing, and media over the past two and a half decades. So I started out working in product development and marketing for a company called CMGI, which was an internet investment company. At one point, it was sort of one of the biggest things happening in the internet. We owned companies like Alta Vista, Ubid, which was a competitor to eBay, Lycos, Raging Bull, lots of...
I haven't heard some of these website names in a long time.
Yeah, these are some of the OGs of the web. And
absolutely.
It was an interesting conglomerate of companies, and it was a Keiretsu model where they all kind of worked together to support one another, which was a benefit as they were growing. But then as the market tightened up, it was actually sort of the poster child, frankly, of the fall. So, you know, as companies started to struggle, that their interdependence with each other caused each of them to fall upon themselves. And, you know, it was a great experience. Met amazing people who all felt they needed to come up to Andover, Massachusetts, where the company was based, to make their pilgrimage to meet with David Weatherall, who was the founder and CEO. And at one point, he was on the cover of Business Week, and the company was worth billions and billions of dollars. So it was a fascinating time, and I've kept in touch with a lot of my colleagues from those days over the years. A bunch of us in 2000 left and went to a startup company, which we built up. We hired bankers, we hired lawyers. We financed the business, and then we ultimately sold it to Symantec. And one of the things that I think we really felt was that the professional service companies that we were hiring and working with didn't really truly understand what was going on, didn't understand the sort of what this internet was all about and where its potential was. And that was just sort of a learning that I had at the time. I then came out of, you know, so when you work in the startup world, either your company succeeds and is bought by a California company and they say, okay, great, we just got bought by Juniper Systems or whatever. Hey, move to California. And I was like, I don't really want to move to California. I like it here in Boston. So you're out of a job. And at the time, you were out of health insurance. And then, you know, your next one you work on and it's like, it didn't work out so well. You know, we crashed. And so you're out of a job. You're out of health insurance. And so I was just having my third child and I felt, God, I got to grow up at some point and start to provide stability to this family I have here. So I'm going to get three jobs. I'm going to be a consultant to three companies. And then if one goes down, I'll have two left and then I'll go get a third again. And my goal was get three clients. And then I also wanted to provide health insurance for myself and the people who worked with me because it was such a rocky road and we felt it was really better to be able to have some stability. So that was really kind of the founding principle around it was just like, get out of this crazy startup world and start and get into you know, more of a stable environment. But anyway, so we started working with companies really around strategy work, around helping them with go-to-market strategy, accessing new markets. This is right after 9/11. So everything was kind of frozen and people were unsure where their next markets might be. And we started helping companies and with that. And then they said, hey, love the strategy. We really need some money. Could you help us raise money? So this is now getting into 2003 and four, when the markets were extremely tight. No one was investing in anything. And we went around and helped a lot of little, very little companies raise their first capital. This is $3, $5, $7, $10 million raises. And we did this for about 5 years and had some great success. And I remember sitting down with somebody, like a real investment banker, one day, 5 years into the business. And he said, you know, Nick, I just want to tell you that, you know, my colleagues and I, we're all very impressed that you're still in business, because not only do you do the worst part of investment banking, which is financing, capital raise, but you also do it for people who, by definition, have no money. So they're startups. You're just taking on all their risk. And, you know, it's like we do M&A. We do this stuff like where we sell companies. We go and buy companies. And in the M&A world, with more mature companies and clients, you have things like clients. You know, your clients have customers. They have revenue. They have EBITDA. They have CFOs. They have finance teams. You're doing it all. It's just amazing that you're still in business. And I was like, I walked away from that, scratching my head and thinking, yeah, that is kind of tough. Like maybe we should do some of that M&A stuff. So, and at the time, some of our clients were actually saying, hey, we're ready to sell. Hey, now we're ready to go buy another company. And so we kind of figured that out and worked our way into it. So as the firm now roll forward, you know, 15, 20 years, we now are 35 people based in Boston with an office in New York and DC. We expanded our original focus, which was advertising, marketing, and media tech and sort of the B2B businesses. We now do media content. We also bought a firm down in DC that does GovTech, GovCon, and government technology, but also for the Defense Department, but also SaaS software, managed service providers. We do some ed tech. So we do a bunch of different things, and we've diversified our sectors, but it's always still been based around subject matter experts who are real professionals who had a full career in those sectors and really can connect with the management teams and the boards around what the businesses are about. And that's kind of been our tenet. So we've continued to convert, if you will, operators into bankers. We certainly have also, say, about half and half now of bankers who have joined us to join our platform and gone boutique. But we still have a number of bankers who also were in business development or corporate development at companies and have come to join us here. So that's sort of the story of how we got from 9/11 to here, and I'm very happy about the team we have and the work we're doing. And every year, you know, we're working with better and bigger and more interesting companies, and we enjoy that. One of the things we left behind was that we stopped doing the early stage capital raises. It is God's work, and we did enough of it, so we feel comfortable in our future passage into the gates of heaven. But we do later stage capital raise as a bank, but we decided, you know, we've got this great network of entrepreneurs, and people kept coming to us saying, hey, you know, I want to go raise $3 million. And we said, you know, instead of going and raising that money from this network of VCs and charging a small banking fee of a few hundred thousand dollars, what if we put in a few hundred thousand dollars and we become the catalyst for the round, we lead it, and we go syndicate it? And so we just sort of flipped it a little bit from the banking model to essentially the venture model. And that's how we started Progress Ventures. We did that a few times with our own money. And then we ran out of our own money, so we had to go get other people's money, and we started full formal fund structures. And then today, we are in our fourth fund. We've brought in Liberty Global, Sinclair Broadcasting, Quad Graphics, and TransUnion, all as strategic investors who are interested in our fund focus, which is B2B advertising, marketing, and media tech, still focused on the original sectors we covered. And we've done very well. We're at a DPI of about 2.25 and a TVPI of around 3, 3.5. So we've really done a remarkable job, I think, for as small a group as we are. and brought on a great executive with whom I worked 25 years ago at CMGI, actually, to run that group named Adrian Zermulin. We've now built up a nice venture business. We're going to be out. We're out actually right now raising our fifth fund, which we hope to be $75 million.
Well, I mean, first of all, congratulations to you and to your entire team on the incredible success story that Progress Partners has been. I did want to ask you just a couple of questions to dig deeper on some of the points that you mentioned. One of them was really starting out doing relatively small ticket capital raise advisory and growing that over time. Two questions there. The first, what has been your observation around the shifting perception among within the buy side as it relates to brokered capital raise transactions, especially at the early stage? And secondly, you know, what would you say the current mix is between large capital raise versus M&A transactions are within Progress Partners today?
Sure. I mean, I think part of the everything has to do really with timing. At the time we were doing these early stage capital raises in 2003 and 4 and 5, the market was very tight and entrepreneurs needed the help. In reality, venture investors see a brokered transaction for a venture round, a Series A, a seed, even a Series B sometimes, as a handicap to the management team. I think they see, VCs really see the job of the CEO to go raise that round as kind of a badge of accomplishment, you know, that they can do it themselves. I think once you get to, you know, Series B, but certainly CDE, these are fully functioning larger businesses. The CEO should be out running the business. And it's expected with those later rounds that, you know, it's natural or normal to bring in a banker to help facilitate that transaction, that later stage capital raise. So that was in part why we also moved away from it. We started to feel that pushback of, you know, hey, I don't really want to take my little $3 million investment and spend, you know, the first $250,000 out the door to pay you, right? So that was part of it. As for us, you know, today we do capital raises kind of in the, you know, 20 to 50 million dollar range. We have one that's sort of a 50 to 75 we're working on right now, but these are our more mature companies. We don't do as much capital raise, certainly as we did back in those days. We're seeing it more. People are coming. I think, you know, capital's tight, and so people need the help and need to expand their network of potential investors. So we're seeing that work coming to us more. And but, you know, our firm is mostly an M&A shop, sell side and buy side.
And then just wanted to double tap on something that I find to be incredibly innovative, which is the build out of a venture fund effectively as being connected to the investment banking operation of Progress Partners. And I wanted to just understand a little bit more, just from your perspective, the ways in which you think that Progress Partners is uniquely equipped now also as a venture fund to identify unique investment opportunities in your coverage areas.
Yeah, we definitely run them as two separate businesses. They have their separate teams. We're all in the same office, but at the same time, we think of them in a very separate way. We don't bank our portfolio, which is to say, you know, we're not investing in companies so that we can generate banking fees for the banking side. That's not at all our goal or our interest. You know, essentially what the portfolio companies get is a board member who is conveniently a banker, you know, or in my case, also a former operator. So we talk about that we've sort of sat in all the seats at the table. You know, we've been board members, we've been board members and investors, we've been operators, we've been bankers, so we can kind of have different perspectives to help our companies. And frankly, it works on both sides. So there's a great amount of, I think, valuable information flow between the two sides of the business around pricing, around kind of just general trends, around the health of businesses. I mean, we've invested in 35 or 37 companies at this point. And so, you know, we can very quickly find out, and it's fairly sector specific around advertising, marketing, and media tech. So we can go and find out kind of, you know, what are some of the trends? Is the, you know, is the ad market tightening up, or is it, you know, or is, are people doing great? And so I think, you know, we leverage the two sides of the business. And certainly we'll have companies come to us asking to raise money that'll be too big for us. And we'll say, you know, you should go talk to the banking side, and vice versa. So I think it's been great. And I think it's, you know, I think it's a model that, you know, will continue. Our investors are strategic. They want to see a return, and we've produced a return. So we're not worried about that. But, you know, they want to see us investing in the kinds of companies that could be, and this is to one of your questions, was, you know, sort of poking, you know, sort of seeing around the corner of what's the future. Well, one of the ways we do that on the banking side is that we're also investors in early stage companies that are the next cycle of innovation for the sectors we operate in. So I can't tell you the number of times we've gone and pitched a bigger company on the banking side and, you know, like, hey, we can do this for you, we can do that for you. And they're like, tell us more about your venture business. I'm really curious about that. And that's actually how we got some of those guys to start investing in us as a kind of an extension for them into earlier stage companies.
Right. It's a way to really take the long view on managing and developing new relationships in the market, that you have more to offer that relationship, because you're also a potential source of deal flow and capital. Just to switch gears a little bit, I was spending, in preparation for this interview, I was spending some time on the Progress Partners website. And one of the things that stood out really was at the top of the website, it says that it helps clients, that the investment bank helps clients to take advantage of technology forces disrupting the industry. And in the list that accompanies that assertion, it really starts with AI and machine learning.
Right.
And obviously, if you've been awake over the last month or two, it would be impossible to miss the remarkable developments with OpenAI and ChatGPT and how they've taken the tech world by storm. And the curiosity for me is really, I'd love to learn more regarding how Progress Partners has been able to capitalize on these sorts of developments in particular, especially given your coverage area focus. Any perspectives on that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we, like anyone else, have seen AI and machine learning show up in every, whether it's on the venture side, every pitch or every company, it's feeling like they need to try to, you know, indoctrinate and engage AI and ML into their story. You know, I'm sure their boards are saying, hey, they're all reading the same thing and saying, what are we doing in AI? You know, so I'm sure everyone is trying to figure that out. I think what we, so many of our portfolio companies have been using AI and ML for years. And, you know, it's that kind of technology or that kind of approach to innovation that creates, you know, the efficiencies that make, you know, the technology solution more beneficial to their customers at a lower cost and so forth. So that's been going on for years. I think on some levels, we had a good conversation around the team last week as that New York Times article came out about the journalist discussion with Sydney and just kind of how scary and the relationship can go, as I guess the journalist was sort of probing into asking some questions.
I read it. It was a haunting piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you read the whole thing.
Yeah. I guess you could actually read the whole script of what they talked about anyway. And I think there's business application that we're very interested in, but I think there's also, you know, for sure kind of concern of like, where do we go next? And like, is anybody like holding on, you know, onto the power plug over it whether it's at Google or Microsoft, where they can like unplug this thing in case it suddenly says like, you know, I'm taking over. So, but yeah, I think AI and ML is just, you know, it's just a next generation of technologies that are being employed in pretty much everything. I've seen some charts saying like, hey, we should go after AI companies. And there's a whole, you know, chart of all the different companies in that sector. I think that these are technologies that are just going to be pervasive in every sector. And so I think, you know, we look at that and I think we've seen a lot of benefit for the companies in trying to, you know, employing these technologies. And I think it's just, you know, that's the future of the way things are going to go. So.
Well, one of the juxtapositions that you drew earlier in the conversation was just this juxtaposition between technology companies on the one hand and professional services businesses on the other hand. And I wonder whether you also see opportunities for these AI technologies to deliver better unit economics and efficiencies within a professional services context.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gotten to the point of saying, you know, hey, write me a sim for this company and in 10,000 words, and you know, here's their website. Have at it. I don't think we're there. You know, I think on the professional services side, it's definitely helpful on the research side. I mean, so you know, you can just go to you know, I guess it's now Bing, but you know, or ask Sydney a question and say, you know, tell me. I was just doing this actually with my son recently. He does some investing for a firm in New York, and was just, you know, had the name of a company and said, hey, tell me about this company. What's their funding history? What's their, who are their competitors? And like, dude did a whole rundown and like, he sent it to me and I was like, that's pretty good. You know, that was, and that took like 4 seconds. So I think that probably puts some pressure on companies, you know, in the data and content space, like a pitch book or something like that. So that, you know, that experience is a lot faster and a lot cheaper than, you know, your PitchBook subscription. I'm not saying we're going to get rid of PitchBook anytime soon, but I mean, those kinds of, that kind of access to information, I think could create a lot of efficiency, you know, for our analysts and associates. And I welcome them. I encourage them to, you know, to use them. I think at the end of the day, though, you know, we're paid as professional services organizations to build books and to look at every cell in a spreadsheet and every paragraph in a sim, and make sure that, you know, we can stand behind it. So I think I don't want that to be a replacement for humans. I'm still a big believer in humans.
Incredibly fascinating. And, you know, one of the things I think about often is if we've been able to get this far, you know, what are the types of advancements that we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years? Because what we're seeing is it really does feel like we're in the mid to late 90s of search.
Right.
Right. Right. Around the time AltaVista was ultimately overtaken by Google, right, as a leading search engine. I feel like we're just about that in that same period of time as it relates to this next generation of AI-enabled search. And I mean, just think of how far that space has evolved and the decacorns that have been created around that technology over that period of time.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. I think that also sort of the world of identity and you know, the deep fakes and all that, I think is also, I think, a challenge, frankly, to democracy, to, you know, the social unrest that we've seen the last few years. You know, if it's certainly possible that, you know, Joe Biden, who just went to, you know, to Kyiv this week, you know, I could see somebody over in Russia taking his speech and changing the words and changing his lips to say, you know, we're coming after you next at Russia, you know, Russia. And that's a pretty scary thought. And so I think that's really where we really need, and this is sort of a philosophical thing for us at Progress. You know, if I think about kind of strip away the projects, the banking fees, the, you know, the all everything else, like what are we here for? I, you know, I really do fundamentally believe in ad supported media. I think, you know, that's a really important, you know, free press and an ad supported media environment is what gives the breadth of distribution of information from, you know, curated and produced by professionals who are professional news gatherers, not just bloggers. And no offense to podcasters or anything like that, but, you know, I think that's a key thing that I think we need to continue to support. And so I'd say if I look back on my career, a lot of it has been trying to help publishers of any sort, you know, remain profitable and successful so they can employ editors and writers to go and find the story and dig and get the true story and information. And so on some levels, this AI, ML, you know, deepfake, ChatGPT kind of is a threat to publishing and the truth in news and so forth. So I don't want to get too political. I'm in the, I live here in the People's Republic of Massachusetts, but you know, that's where we are up here.
I think ChatGPT is a tool, right? Just like search is a tool and social media is a tool. Fire is also a tool. It can cook food and it can burn down buildings. And I think that there's a tremendous opportunity for government and inspired regulation that doesn't get in the way of innovation, but holds the appropriate social safeguards in place to play a role. And we all have some concerns about how that might play out. But, you know, obviously, that it is something to be thinking very carefully about. I wanted to return just to Progress Partners briefly and would love to hear your perspective on what you would say the unique value proposition for Progress Partners is and its approach to serving clients in such a dynamic and rapidly changing market. In other words, what are the dynamics and practices in your longstanding relationships that really enables you to unlock insights and to see around corners as you state on your website?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've always been, you know, we are genuine experts. You know, I historically would have shied away from that and sort of been and not really tried to stand behind that. But I, you know, the more time that we spend focused on the different areas, and each of our bankers has really deep, deep industry expertise and experience, both professionally working in companies, but also doing the banking work and also now the investing work. So that, you know, we've really seen companies from all these different perspectives and lenses, and then can apply that to a company and kind of help predict the response from a counterparty, help position a company in the right way so that, you know, that, you know, my kids used to always ask me, like, what do you do? And I'm like, well, we're professional storytellers. You know, really what we do is we take a company and we turn it into a story, and a story has a beginning, middle, and end, and it has a, you know, as a lesson or a meaning to it. And I think that's really what we are. We're really communicators. We're taking all the tech assets and all the salespeople and all the different components of a business and putting it into a story of where this company has been, where it is today, and where it's going. And I think that to be able to do that successfully, you really have to know what you're talking about, right? You can't just kind of fake it. And I think, you know, we often will meet with companies and we'll spend the first, you know, hour just talking about the industry. And then they'll say, you guys are different. Like most investment banks, they come in and they ask, they're like, okay, what's your EBITDA? Okay, what's your growth rate? Okay, what's your, you know, and then they're like, okay, you're not a good fit for us. And they just walk away. And you guys really seem to be genuinely interested in what we do and also have ideas that we haven't even thought about and are willing to give us leads and connect us with people who could be potential partners. And we haven't even paid you yet. And, you know, so I think we're genuinely interested and genuinely care about the industry that we work in and really want to see it continue to succeed. And sure, we have to have a business model. We have to make money. And I think by doing right by our clients, we've done, you know, well for ourselves.
And I just wanted to ask you on that. And by the way, I completely agree with what you're saying. And I think it would be fair to say that it's likely that Progress Partners' approach is an authentic expression also of who you are, Nick, as somebody who's curious about the world and also just curious about people and relationships, that there's a long view, right? And that long view is also, I think, represented by the fact that you've built your own venture fund as being attached to the overall vision of what you're trying to accomplish in the industry. I'd be curious just to, you know, maybe hear some recent deals or transactions that you've worked on that you think are particularly representative or that you'd like to, you know, basically call out.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, last year was a banner year for us, honestly. Our best year ever. We divested. I mean, one big deal I'm particularly proud of, and one of our bankers, Brett Braze, ran, was the divestiture of a company called Gamut and also Cox Reps from Cox Television. So this is Cox Local Broadcast Television Group divesting technology assets and sales assets away from its core broadcast segment company. And, you know, the work was Cox Television is owned by Apollo. Apollo is a real deal, tough guy, private equity firm. They're highly demanding. And our team really stood up to the challenge and found a great home for them with One Equity Partners. And that was a you know, a really significant deal for us. It was a significant deal, I think, for Cox to be able to pay down a lot of debt and get the company into a very, very strong position for Apollo's future return. So that was that's one that's in the sort of OTT streaming television space. Another one is Media Radar, which is a technology company that is helping publishers understand pricing and sort of the buyer market of advertising. They've done very, very well. Todd Kreitzelman is the CEO there. David Arslanian was the banker on our side. And I think did a terrific job in finding the right partner. And, we worked with the private equity owner to ultimately sell that one to Thompson Street Partners. And again, these are sort of in the $200 to $300 million range exits for these companies. And, those are good, strong, deals for us. I think we did about 11 or 12 deals overall for the year. So certainly some smaller ones as well. But we had a very busy year. We also did deals out of Latin America. I saw that in your bio and your background that you've done some transactions down there. We sold a company called Retargetly to Publicis. And it was a very a good and productive year. I will say that we're quite interested in international deals and have done a lot with Europeans and South American companies. And I think we'll continue to see that in the firm. Again, that's sort of a little bit born out of, as you said, my personality. I like to travel and I'm always interested to, see new countries and cultures. I just went to Israel for the first time in my life just last week. I was there for 10 days and I really was really impressed by the culture, the drive, the technology innovations that the Israelis have built, the general togetherness of that country, even as they go through some political challenges of their own, which they're doing around their Supreme Court and Benjamin Netanyahu, but the singular oneness of Israel was really shown through, and I was impressed by that. So, we're actually pitching an Israeli company or two right now. We invested in a company that was originated out of Israel called Clinch in our venture fund. So that was sort of the genesis of taking that trip, but then it became a lot more and it was a great experience.
Well, some very cool representative transactions. So congrats again to you, Nick, and to Progress Partners on those. And as we look ahead here in 2023, I guess we're already well into Q1. Amazing how the time has gone by in this new year. Just curious to learn more about kind of what your plans or prognostications are for this year, both for Progress Partners as well as for the broader economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that 2023 is going to shape up kind of the reverse of 2022. So 2022 started off well and then went south as the year just kind of like just month after month kind of got worse and worse. We had if you look at the macro picture, you had interest rates at an all-time low and inflation suddenly popped up as high as 8%. And then the Fed, has rapidly been trying to catch up. And so I think that is now inverted. And so now interest rates are now higher than the inflation rate, which is good. And I think that we're going to see 2023, which started off slow, I think accelerate into the second half. And so, we regularly poll all the companies in our portfolio and our clients to see how they're doing and where they see things. And I think people are seeing a softer first half, not a terrible one, because frankly, we're in technology space where everything's still getting digitized, still moving from analog to digital. And, it's all relative, but I think everyone's now sort of recognizing that 2020 to 2022 was really an aberration. It was this sort of pent up growth that came out of COVID and valuations went out of whack. There was no very low interest rates. And I think that created a misperception that companies were worth as much as they were then. And I think we're really going back to and returning to the pre-COVID levels of 2017 to 19, which were healthy. And there's nothing wrong with those times. And so I think that's sort of, I think we see a positive, second half, and then in 2024, I think we'll be back on track. There are these sort of black swan circumstances, like, you know, Ukraine and sort of the European recovery and so forth. But I think in general, you know, we feel quite positive. And so as far as we're concerned, you know, we're, you know, each of our MDs is kind of executing in their own area. I remain very interested in, the just this wholesale shift from satellite cable and over the air television to streaming. You know, these fast channels that people, talk about on platforms like, Roku and Pluto and, Samsung and LG. On those platforms, you know, the viewing habits are moving rapidly over to internet-delivered content, and I think that's going to continue. So we work with a lot of companies that are trying to facilitate those moves and not completely disrupt the publishers, advertiser ecosystem and relationship. And it's not always smooth, but there's some really remarkable companies out there doing some interesting things that will make for, I think, a better, more targeted advertising and viewing experience for consumers, with the ability to do some interesting other things in terms of interacting with video and content around investing around gaming, both video games, but also but betting, but also, you know, interacting with advertisers. You know, so I think this sort of interactive experience on what we've used to call the television screen is going to change dramatically in the next few years.
It will be fascinating to watch for sure. And with that, Nick, I'd just like to thank you so much for joining us here on the Pencils Down podcast.
Sure.
Very much looking forward to continuing the conversation in the days ahead.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Finalis is a broker-dealer platform with everything that M&A advisors, investment bankers, and placement agents need to succeed. We deliver a broker-in-a-box regulatory affiliation solution, replete with tech-enabled compliance, research and analytics, deal lifecycle management tools, and a first-of-its-kind deal marketplace. Learn more at www.finalis.com. You've been listening to Pencils Down, a Finalis podcast. Keep connected with us by subscribing to the show on your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show. That helps us keep covering the latest in the private securities brokerage landscape. Thanks for listening. Until next time.